So I'm only going to make a formal introduction because this is on videotape. But hello, my name is David Malin. I teach Computer Science 50 at the college, which is the introductory computer science course. Long story short, and a few more details in a moment, we started using Amazon EC2 this past fall in order to implement our own course's infrastructure. And by that, I mean we spawned a whole bunch of virtual machines, tied them together in a virtual network, a VLAN, and then students throughout the semester had shell accounts. They used those to then SSH to this cluster in the cloud, where they then had gigabytes of home directory space. They wrote code at the command line, C code, compiled it there, submitted their electronically, and we essentially therefore recreated what some of you might know as fas.harvard.edu or nice.fas.harvard.edu. But before we dive in, the goals of today, at least in my mind, but this is meant to be very casual even though I'm the only one standing up, is to really just give one conceptual overview of what EC2 is and what else is out there, really be interrupted as often as you would like with questions. And I think we're small enough where we can get away with some really rapid introductions where if folks wouldn't mind just saying who you are and what department or group you're from, just why you're here. So in a few sentences or fewer, and then we'll forge ahead. But I did think it was interesting being the one soliciting all of the RSVPs. This is a little bar graph of who RSVP'd. Had in total about 40 people RSVP this way and then about 20 others another way. So we had mostly staff folks interested who expressed an interest in learning something about EC2. And in terms of the affiliations, it was actually kind of neat. I met via email at least a bunch of people from all over the university. So certainly not just within FAS and engineering, but folks from many or most of Harvard schools. So it seems that there's interest. Presumably, this is just half of the folks. We seem to have like 15 new faces here. So there's another such thing on Monday. If you need a refresher as soon as Monday, please feel free to come back. But let me just dive in. So this is how I first learned about EC2. There's this wonderful article in the New York Times, which I copied this excerpt from, and I'll just read it aloud if it's a little small. So the New York Times has decided to make all the public domain articles from 1851 to 1922 available free of charge. These articles are all in the form of images scanned from the original paper. In fact, from 1851 to 1980, all 11 million articles are available as images in PDF format. To generate a PDF version of the article takes quite a bit of work. Each article is actually composed of numerous smaller TIFF images that need to be scaled and glued together in a coherent fashion. I then began, the author of this article being the guy who used EC2. I then began some rough calculations and determined that if I used only 4 machines, it could take some time to generate all 11 million article PDFs. But thanks to the swell people at Amazon, I got access to a few more machines and churned through all 11 million articles in just under 24 hours using 100 EC2 instances, aka virtual machines. In fact, it worked so well that we ran it twice, since after we were done, we noticed an error in the PDFs. So it was actually a really interesting article a couple of years ago now, but it kind of spoke to the flexibility. And if you really read the whole article, you see, well, yes, it took 24 hours to run, but it took him like 2 weeks to actually get it up and running and set up. But the fact that he was at least able to run it again so quickly at least says something. I'll say that, let's just give a quick overview here. So most of the audience here is presumably fairly technical, so you're probably at least generally familiar with the notion of virtualization. But just to put a definition behind the jargon, so virtualization is typically refers to creating within software the illusion of a machine on top of another machine. And this is increasingly enticing these days as the world has 8 core machines, 16 core machines. We have more resources than at least a typical human has needs for. So even within organizations, can you buy fairly cheap commodity hardware and then divide it up in software to create the illusion of multiple servers. And now you have very nice sandboxing. If one machine goes down, one virtual machine, the other one doesn't go down. And there's a whole bunch of implementations out there, free and not free, for this solution. So the one we'll implicitly be talking about today is known as Xen. It came from the University of Cambridge. It now has actually a commercial wrapper around it, but you can use it for free. Even a buddy of mine in New York uses it to manage all of the servers for a real estate company that he runs. It's fairly user-friendly, but there's even more user-friendly versions out there. Sort of the big fish is VMware. Unfortunately, you really pay for VMware, at least in a commercial enterprise. So we, CS50, have been using to some extent what's called ESX server, which is one of their flagship products that costs a lot of money, a couple $1,000s generally, I think, per CPU. At least we had the fortune of getting it for free for academic purposes. So, I mean, fortunately, we have a selective audience here, which might be an option for folks as well. But I'll caution in general, the rule of thumb in free versus non-free has been if you're using it for IT purposes, even inside a university, you're going to pay for it. But if you're using it for students or faculty, it's less likely that you'll have to pay for it. So there's a whole bunch of products, Workstation, Fusion, Server. Some of these are for Macs, some of these are for PCs, some of these are meant for servers. But if you have any questions about any of these, because we've dabbled with many of them, do just shout out or grab us after. Parallels, Microsoft has some solutions. Sun has VirtualBox. So I'll make mention of this only because I'm currently very excited about this. So long story short, we in CS50 have been podcasting the course's content for a couple of years now, making videos available, PDFs and all of that. But the bar has still been pretty high to outsiders to actually engage actively in the course. It's been a fairly passive process for podcastees where they can watch the videos and they can email us, but we're not really set up to take in emails and answer questions from outsiders. But it takes a degree of savvy that technically one probably doesn't have if they're watching Introduction to Computer Science videos to actually install Linux or Cygwin or something on their machines to get GCC and GDB up and running, which are all of the tools we use in the course. So we're actually very excited this fall to be releasing for our own students and also outsiders a downloadable virtual machine, so CS50 in a box, which will essentially be a downloadable version of what we know as FAS people as nice.fas.harvard.edu, aka cs50.net. And what this means in real terms is people will be able to download a like 300 meg, 600 meg, it'll depend on how much stuff we put into it, virtual machine image. They download Sun's VirtualBox client-side software, which is also free and is a much smaller download. And what's very compelling is it exists for Macs, PCs, and Linux, and maybe even Solaris environments. And that's in contrast to pretty much every other option I know of, because even with VMware, there's a hitch where it's free for PCs, but the Mac version, Fusion, you have to pay for. Now, not if you're a student, but if you're an outsider. So for those interested in sort of smaller type of virtualizations, I would just urge you, from my own experience, this is really exciting stuff. And the fact that it's free is itself very compelling. Oh, it does run Solaris. Okay. So even, well, yeah. Actually, yes, I should hope so. So yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And it's actually, it's at version 3 or something where it's mature enough, works very well. It's certainly imperfect. Even I, this past weekend, tripped over various bugs. But it's a really interesting thing to experiment, especially if you don't want to deal with dedicating yourself to just one platform. So we're very excited, at least. Then there's some other options, free and not free. And they vary, I'll say, in terms of this technical sophistication that they require. VirtualBox pretty much took the VMware approach of really simplifying things. Cute, big icons you click on. Whereas Xen, even though I imagine there are front ends these days, is a more arcane interface, a little more technically savvy. A little more technical savvy is probably assumed, command line stuff. So this is sort of a topic for maybe an at-home exercise, but there's different types of virtualization that probably do affect you if you really, really care of performance and if you are tied already to certain hardware and or operating systems. But realize, and frankly, Wikipedia is a wonderful friend for discussions like this. Each of the various vendors and products we look at, they take somewhat different approaches, and there are implications for performance. But Xen is what Amazon EC2 uses. And I'll say up front that Amazon, I think, is similarly, like VirtualBox for clients, Amazon EC2 and Xen specifically is really exciting, to be honest. I know of no other product out there that makes it so damn easy to just spawn a virtual machine when you want it, be a dime, literally, if you use it for an hour or less, shut it off, and you're done. And during that time, you have access to a complete shell, a kernel, which you have some discretion over. You can install software at will. You can allocate space. You have a network connection, a public IP address. I mean, you get a lot more on demand than you do with a typical provider. And so I'll give you a quick summary of alternatives to something like EC2 so you have a sense of the landscape, at least as far as we've figured it out by experimenting ourselves. So we also use in other courses I teach a VPS, virtual private server. It's the same idea, just a buzzword around the same notion. And there's some popular medium size or small size fish, Linode, Servant, Tectonic, VPS LAN. We use Servant, and we've actually been very happy. And this is a screenshot of Servant's offerings. And I think the resolution's a little suffering. We pay for, at a discounted rate, essentially what's blurry right here. So we use for multiple courses I teach, and it's kind of sort of CS50, we get a virtual machine. It's implemented using a product called Virtuoso, related to Parallels. One, you get 125 gigabytes of disk space, 3.5 terabytes of internet traffic, 4 gigabytes of guaranteed RAM, and then there's some burstability. When you typically go with vendors like these guys, it's typically a process of filling out a form online. Then within 12 to 24 hours, some human gets back to you because they've manually provisioned your server. They themselves know precisely what physical machine it's on. And they do oversell to some extent because this is how they offer burstability. Like, I can use up to 8 gigabytes of RAM, but unfortunately, even we recently moved CS50's website, which is still for legacy purpose hosted on this thing. We moved it and my other course to another physical machine at our request of Servant because their other customers were churning through more resources than they should have been. So there are some impacts there, but what's compelling, frankly, still about these offerings and a shortcoming, I think, of EC2 is that EC2 small white lie, only has ephemeral storage. So when you spawn a virtual machine in EC2 or an instance, you have a whole bunch of hard disk space, probably a few gigabytes. But if you shut that virtual machine down, any changes you made to the disk image go away. Now, it's a small white lie because they do offer what is called Elastic Block Store. It's a fancy name of saying you can mount peer-to-be block devices. You can allocate block devices that have between a gigabyte and a terabyte of space. Can attach them to any instance, and that actually is a plus. You can attach the same volume to any EC2 instance that you might have access to, and if you do all of your installation of software and configuration files on that particular volume, then you do in fact have persistent storage. But I would say that I've not been a fan of this gotcha, because if I want to just install some software in one of CS50's virtual machines, I'd like to just run Aptitude, or I'd like to run Yum, hit enter, and even if the machine crashes or I shut it down intentionally, I'd kind of like I can do with these guys, boot it back up and everything is still the same. Now, it's also what I said, a small white lie, because you can make a copy of your disk image. It's just a more involved process. You can make your own what's called Amazon Machine Image, and we'll play around with this stuff hands-on today, which is their fancy way of saying disk image. But that process generally takes, in our experience, 10, 20 minutes. It's not as simple as just clicking a button. And then what you would do is, if you shut down your machine and you want that same state back, you spawn in a virtual machine based on that disk image. In other words, you have to think things through more. And so what this meant for us in CS50 in real terms is we took care when creating CS50's cluster of many virtual machines. We used Yum to install software that we knew we'd need the whole term. We're going to bother probably updating things like GCC over the course of 4 months mid-semester. We just left things alone, earned an Amazon machine image, and then spawned multiple copies of it. But there were things we would change on a daily or weekly basis, like config files and like vimrc files and stuff like this. And we certainly didn't want to have to like SSH to 6-box virtual machines, change them all manually. We could have used rsync or something to propagate changes, but even then, if we shut all 6 machines down, the changes would go away. So we made heavy use of symbolic links. We had an EBS volume connected to our instances. We NFS exported that disk space to our other instances, and we just took care that things like etsy foo were symlinked to that Elastic Block Store. So there are solutions, but it's not as simple a mental model as these guys. And in my experience, if I've ever wanted just one virtual machine, even still, I pay someone like $50 a month for this, as opposed to just going for Amazon, if I want the instance up and running for some time, say the whole year. Because we'll see in a moment that the costs do add up. EC2 might not be a good solution if you're planning on running something 24/7, 365, because at least ignoring human costs and HVAC and electrical, the raw CPU cycles themselves do add up. That's perhaps the biggest cost. Any questions? Just going quickly so we get to the fun part. No? Okay. Well, please interrupt if so. So there's another alternative altogether that we actually vetted, not for CS50, but for a consulting gig that I was working on last year, we had a whole bunch of servers. There were only a couple of us humans, and we really didn't have co-location space at the time. And so we considered these guys, which is actually a pretty popular player out there, Rackspace, which isn't really virtualization, though it could be. They kind of abstract away those details, but you essentially pay IT guys elsewhere to run your servers for you. So it's actually nice, especially for startups, I think, in principle, if you don't have the technical savvy or you just don't have the physical space, which is increasingly a problem even even here in CS, to actually get an infrastructure up and running. But you pay for it because you're paying not only for the renting the hardware, but also renting the humans. So for us, it was just cost prohibitive. Cloud computing. Does anyone, just to give my voice a break for a second, want to offer a definition as you know it of cloud computing? Clearly, I play the role of teacher sometimes, so I need a break from talking. What is cloud computing, if anyone will proffer a definition?
When the server closet gets human.
Okay. And what else? Now you're on the hook for a real answer. Okay. Yeah. So in my opinion, it's more of a buzzword than anything, but it just generally describes the ability to rent or spawn on demand computing resources that are elsewhere. And you, the owner or the renter of those resources, shouldn't have to care, you know, what server it's actually running on, what data center it's actually in. Hopefully you can abstract away details like what city it's in, even though the farther away the hardware is, then you run into some latency issues. Even we'll touch on briefly, since we tripped over those issues ourselves. There are different big fish out there, although some of them are sort of in pre-launch phase. So EC2, and I'm happy to be corrected, is the only service I know of that can do the kind of stuff that we will end up doing today with such ease. We will literally be able, after some hiccups, I'm sure, like setting environment variables and such, be able to spawn virtual machines to which we can SSH or RDP, in the case of Windows, within 60 seconds. That's really hard to match elsewhere. Not only can we do that, we can type in the number 100, hit enter, and do exactly what the New York Times did, also in 60 seconds. Though you will see, if you choose to spawn a Windows VM, the Windows VMs actually take like 5 minutes to boot up, whereas the Linux boxes are much faster. So there's Google App Engine 2, which is kind of in this cloud space, but you have to start interpreting cloud a little more generously. We looked at them too, but that's essentially right now a managed environment. You can write some Python code, some Java code, and I think they can or will support other languages as well. You upload your application, they run it, and you have no knowledge or care about what it's running on or how it's all interconnected. So it's really a managed environment, not for shell accounts and for low-level Linux-y stuff, but really just for running an application. And I think it is interesting. For us, it didn't solve a problem that we had. We essentially put it off the table. So Microsoft Azure, I went to a talk at some conference from a Microsoft guy. To be honest, I'm not as clear on what Azure is. I'm not sure it's been launched yet. And I even walked out of this meeting with a bunch of brochures, and I still didn't understand what it was. So I'm not trying to pick on Microsoft, but I'm just unclear on what that offering is. But my sense was it was more like App Engine than it is EC2. But again, I'm happy to be corrected. So we just didn't spend much time on that because EC2 for us solved the very specific goal we had in mind, which was recreating FAS's cluster, but in the cloud. So here's a quick list of some of the services Amazon provides. So just a couple years ago, AWS, as they like to call themselves, which is really the offshoot of their CTO, who wanted Amazon to start selling way more than books, has built out this suite of services. And a couple of years ago, Amazon Web Services lets you like fetch via various XML protocols, like book information and reviews and prices. Now it refers to some really sophisticated services, only two of which we'll touch on today, and even then, mostly EC2. But a quick overview, EC2 is all about spawning virtual machines on demand, as you'll see. S3 is their storage service, which EC2 uses as its backend, even though that's an abstracted away detail that you shouldn't need to care about. But S3 is increasingly being used, even by folks like the New York Times, where you have a lot of data that you need a storage space for. It's relatively cheap. Even in the long term. Pricey things we'll see today are when you keep your machines running for a lot of CPU hours. They have SimpleDB, which is kind of a database API. CloudFront, which is a new, I think, monitoring service that's trying to make it even easier to manage resources in the cloud without having to care about individual instances going down, for instance. I'm not as familiar with the queue service, but MapReduce is very interesting in the distributed computing space. And I know there's a couple of folks here within the engineering school that are considering that service as well. And I believe today you'll exit with, as I promised, $100 in EC2 credits, which is maybe why some folks are here. But you'll be able to use those credits for any of these services. So realize that you'll get to play with a whole bunch more stuff than we even look at today. But this is what we did. So this is the canonical picture we show to our students as to what cs50.net, cloud.cs50.net was. So the workflow we wanted, again, to create for students is they sit down on campus or at home. They have a laptop on the internet. They want to SSH to cloud.cs50.net, where they have a username and password. They log in. They have a home directory with a whole bunch of storage space where they can save .c files, compile stuff, ultimately run PHP code and all of that. But no matter which machine they SSH to, we wanted a uniform environment, just like nice.fas. So we had we implemented this in the cloud. We spawned spawned a whole bunch of virtual machines, one of which was a director or front end, as we called it, and then the other N-1 machines were backends, as we called them. Essentially, students ended up on any one of these machines, and they were just workhorses. They had SSHD running, they had GCC, GDB, all of the tools. The front end was the fun box for us to configure, because this is the guy that was running LDAP, it was running NFS, it was running Linux Virtual Server, which is a load balancing solution. So what happened at the layer three, layer four is students would SSH to cloud.cs50.net, which would resolve to this box. They would then be, via heuristic, routed pseudo-randomly to one of these guys back here, and then they had full access to all of the tools we wanted to provide them with. So I'll point out that this clearly has a single point of failure. For us, that was acceptable, partly because we didn't really have time to do things that were more sophisticated. But we certainly could have. Two, the simplicity, frankly, appealed to me, and even now. I mean, I had never touched LDAP. I had never touched NFS. I'd used it as a user, but there was just a huge learning curve for us. But we were ultimately really happy, or at least I was really happy with what we were able to pull off. And a lot of it was experimentation. We used a program called VTUN, which if you'd like this afternoon, you'll be able to play with as well, which allowed us to create virtual encrypted tunnels between these EC2 instances pairwise. And that's how we were able to NFS export an EBS volume, persistent storage, to any of these boxes out here. So our hope, as an aside, is actually to package up our AMIs, our configuration, and release them to really anyone out there who wants to play, ideally at other universities. And frankly, I think we're going to prioritize simplicity as opposed to fault tolerance, at least for an environment. And knock on wood, in 4 months, none of this went down in any sort of major way. And to be clear, or even to just to put it on the table, the motivation for all of this, I'll admit, was partly because it was fun. No one that we knew of was really doing it. So that appealed to us as an intro CS class, and me personally. And also, too, it addressed a couple of problems or shortcomings. So the wonderful thing about nice.fas for years is that it provides this framework. It's very simple conceptually. Students SSH, they get load balanced to a box. They don't care where they're at. It's all very uniform. But we, as a course, wanted to be able to install a more recent version of GCC or GDB, not the one that's been there for 5 years. And rightly so, a lot of the sysadmins on campus resist users' requests for the latest and greatest because it impacts other people's potentially negatively. I mean, we as a course with our students are a little less risk averse and a little more eager to try out the latest and greatest. So, Frank, long story short, we wanted root access, and we were never going to get it on a shared environment. And pedagogically, and I'm not sure even I appreciated this enough in the beginning, the fact that we were able to then use SU and become students and actually see their code, see their bugs, see their compiler errors in its native environment, so to speak, was huge, because it just saved us time. It saved us gratuitous emails going back and forth, students failing to send attachments properly, having to download code to our own accounts and compile it. I mean, so many steps were eliminated by that simple built-in Linux feature. So for us, it was huge. And we do plan to use this approach or our own local virtualized approach this fall and perhaps next, just because those value adds, in the end, I think, definitely outweighed the ridiculous number of hours I and Glenn and others put into this project. But the versatility of what EC2 is what made all of this possible. So we were very happy, but I will put out there, quite frankly, I screwed up several times. And some of the problems I'll summarize in a bit were largely problems of system administration or lack of technical savvy on my part than it was any fundamental fault of these services. Well, there are some gotchas I'll allude to. So quick quiz. AMI, Amazon Machine Image, is what? Perfect. custom disk image that you've made. OK, an instance?
Running
virtual machine. And EBS volume. OK, and that just means what? Yeah, so it's just a persistent disk volume that you can mount on any running instance. You can't mount them on multiple instances, as is often the case with storage, but you can mount them on any one instance and move it really rapidly. So what's really neat and what you'll get to play with today is really your choice of operating system. Somewhat in the past few months, they've rolled out support for Windows-based virtual machines, which is certainly of interest to some. There's a whole bunch of Linux distributions that Amazon has kind of endorsed by being involved in the creation of these images. It's possible to create your own base image by creating an empty file with the equivalent of DD and then filling it with the latest installation of CentOS and whatnot. We've not done that ourselves, partly because it's so much easier to start with someone else's base image that you can trust to a degree. But there's an increasingly large community of people who are packaging up their own AMIs. And we'll see even today, there's a pre-built LAMP server, Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP, so that you have what are increasingly being called appliances, where you click a button, you get a pre-configured box, much like we'll try to do for other schools and courses with CS50, that you have a pre-configured setup. But you'll have a whole range of options. We used Fedora, partly because it was the first Linux distro that Red Hat Amazon was putting out there, and I was familiar with that general distribution. We're probably going to move to Ubuntu Linux this year, just so that we're running all one Linux distro, and because we're using Ubuntu for the VirtualBox project as well. And the staff are fans of the distribution. So here comes the money, the final statistics, and then playtime. So this stuff is all documented on Amazon's website. Hopefully these slides, just taking them home with you, will at least put it all in one place. But essentially, we'll soon be doing this. You'll be creating Amazon instances running virtual machines, but you have discretion over the size of the virtual machines you're running, the specs of the virtual machines. So right now, what Amazon offers are, for what they call standard instances, three different sizes, small, large, and extra large. There's never been a medium for some reason. You can see here, you can get a summary just visually of what the various specs are. But worthy of note are terms like this. So EC2 compute units. Roughly an EC2 compute unit is 1 gigahertz, though technically it's 1 to 1.2 gigahertz. And that's just a fudge factor so that they can use Intel chips or AMD chips and not have to guarantee a precise number of gigahertz. I think it's easiest just to think of it as 1 gigahertz. 64-bit and 32-bit, so that does have implications for folks. And notice you can't have a small 64-bit platform. You can't have an extra large 32-bit platform. We, as a course, went with 32-bit everything, which constrained us to a certain set of instances. There's actually another screenful here, but just realize that you need to be consistent, certainly, with certain software. So realize that distinction. But there are what are called high CPU instances, which is actually what we ended up using, particularly for our backends, because we didn't need a lot of disk space. I mean, they're writing C programs and intro C programs, but they're writing programs to crack passwords at one point in the course, and they're writing infinite loops in some programs unintentionally. So CPU is what we were mostly bound by. So we did pay for high CPU instances using the medium instance here for 32-bit platform. But you'll be able today to spawn different instances, and you'll see that there are different prices associated with those. So in just one second. So there's also some discretion you'll have today and in general. You can choose different regions or availability zones for spawning your instances. And the simplest mental model here is Amazon has different data centers. You can pick which one your virtual machines are going to run in. The idea here is that you, as the designer of your cloud topology, have some discretion, or you have some ability to implement some degree of fault tolerance by making sure that all of your eggs are not in just one data center. You can actually have instances running here, here, or here. Or better yet, and this is the contingency plan we had in place in my mind, if anything bad ever happened in US East 1, which was the data center all of our CS50 machines were in, we could, because we had thought in advance to burn an Amazon AMI to disk, which goes to S3, which is an independent service, which is irrespective of all of this stuff. We knew we could, if we got to a computer quickly enough, respawn our entire infrastructure in a different availability zone, therefore in a different data center. Yeah.
So presumably these 1A, 1B, 1C,
Not necessarily, but what Amazon guarantees is that there are no physical dependencies between any of these availability zones. So they are served by different power grids, they are served by different ISPs, or at least none of which have dependencies that you should in theory need to worry about.
So like US East 1A as being in Boston, that might be
correct. Correct, and they make no promises as to where these things are. And in fact, our friends at Amazon hinted once that US East is actually in the Midwest at the moment, which did have implications for us, which one of our concerns was latency for X-based applications for our cloud environment. So that's one of the bullet points we'll conclude with today. But it does have implications. At least Amazon's not at, let's say, a maturity level right now where they're willing to commit to certain geographies beyond saying you're in Europe, you're in the US, and roughly on the East Coast. But building out an infrastructure that has instances running in each of these can facilitate fault tolerance, or just having the discretion to move your infrastructure to another availability zone also can help you mitigate some downtime, which there has been a history of, though not an egregious one. And I'll note, too, Amazon supports what are called elastic IP addresses, because you might, if you sort of think through the logic of just moving your whole infrastructure, DNS problems. Well, Amazon actually does a whole bunch of network address translation, whereby they abstract away IP addresses where we pay for a few cents a day an IP address that we have bound via DNS to cloud.cs50.net. But thanks to Amazon's layering, you can actually map that IP address, the elastic IP, to a different instance in a different availability zone within, they say, 15 minutes. And we've seen it happen much, much faster. So that we for accepted, I accepted in my mind, yes, in the we could go down for at least 15 minutes in if I screw up, Amazon screws up. The reality, though, is this is sort of behind our motivation and is not meant to be critical as it is motivating for us. I mean, the staff here historically work 9 to 5, and I mean, quite literally, our users work from 5 to 9. And when problems happen, it's on Thursday night right before problem sets due, and we've just never had the luxury of submitting a trouble ticket waiting. Well, this has been the reality, but it's been an unfortunate reality because academically it affects our syllabus, because if we have to grant extensions, everything gets screwed up. And so that, too, motivated me to take an interest in solving that problem, because between Glenn, myself, and one of our undergraduates, I mean, one of us is literally awake every hour of the day. So we have good coverage just by nature of our lifestyles, for better or for worse. But that's a cost. The number of hours I put in, including today and Monday, ironically, is a hidden cost to all of this. So here's the pricing, just copied from Amazon's website. It's been pretty consistent over the months. I don't think these have changed throughout the year we've used it. But here's essentially what you pay for within the United States. So for that thing called small, large, and extra large, which you have in your cheat sheets there, you'll pay 10 cents an hour, 40 cents an hour, or 80 cents an hour. So it goes up significantly. 10 cents an hour is really kind of fun to play with, because it takes a while for that to add up. But when you start paying a dollar an hour, and then start multiplying out 24 hours in a day, 7 days in a week, and all of that. I mean, in the end, if you can do back of the envelope calculations today if you want, you'll end up paying several thousand dollars for an instance that's equivalent to like a Dell or an HP box that you'd probably pay roughly the same price. With that said, you don't have to host it yourself. You don't need electrical power. You don't need cooling. You don't need an IT staff, so long as you're willing to take on that role yourself. So it's not, I think it's worth considering, especially if not obvious, like it's not just dollars, I think, that should be considered. And for better or for worse, my time is free, since I don't pay myself to do this stuff. But certainly for folks who are doing this, I think, on a professional basis, I mean, these hours add up. I'm just willing to tolerate it because I find it so interesting and pedagogically motivating. There's also reserved instances, which help chip away at the problem of costs adding up. Reserved instance means you pay an up fee, and then you pay a lower margin cost. And so you just have to do the math with a calculator or a spreadsheet to figure out where the sweet spot is for your use cases. Data transfer. So there's a lot of costs. And I don't mean to overwhelm with some of the numbers, and certainly don't try to memorize this stuff. I will say, I'll quantify all of this. The cost you just saw, the CPU hours, for us was by far the biggest cost on a recurring basis. So the rest of this, sort of nickel and diming things. But it was interesting for us, for our workflow. But mind you, we did not have a lot of bandwidth usage. We did not have a lot of disk I/O, because again, these are fairly small text files. But I'll say right now, we don't host our podcasts in the cloud because it would cost us a fortune. We would blow through the donation that Amazon gave us within weeks, because even one of my courses at the Extension School historically gets about 4 terabytes of downloads per month. I mean, that alone blows through most allocations on any hosted environment you can find. So we've used various donations to solve that problem, or Harvard's own bandwidth, which at least we're several layers away from that, so we don't pay explicitly for that. So data transfer. So here's the numbers, just to give you a sense of data in, data out. So it's actually, I think, technically interesting. If we had a malicious student who just wanted to transfer really big movie files back and forth, or who were using their EC2 account for illegal movies or whatever, I mean, we could have been penalized by malicious users. And it didn't happen. I would say the monitoring tools exist, but they're perhaps not as sophisticated as I'm sure they eventually will be. But there are some gotchas there, too, that literally malicious users, whether your own or random script kiddies on the internet pinging the heck out of your instances, can mean money for you. So I think that's worth at least considering. Data transfer too. So there's also cost when you have data going from availability zone to availability zone. So if you, just because you think it's good for fault tolerance, put an instance here and in 1B and in 1C, but then are constantly rsyncing across them, removing files, it's going to cost you, as opposed to keeping it within a data center, because Amazon's presumably paying for the bandwidth. Elastic IP addresses, I mean, again, nickel and diming things, these things don't really add up significantly. But you pay for elastic IP addresses as well. Snapshots. So this is actually both useful and not terribly expensive. With EBS, the Elastic Block Store, where we kept all of our 300 students' home directories, all of our configuration files, even the smallest Etsy files, we used Amazon Snapshots, which from a UI perspective is as simple as clicking a button, and that takes a moment in time snapshot. It does it lazily, so it'll eventually get around to finishing it, but when you click that button, it will take a snapshot of the volume. Now, there are some gotchas that I've read of. If you're running MySQL or a database engine, Amazon generally recommends that you stop your instance, stop the service before you actually do these backups, just so you don't risk data corruption. But for our use case, just taking snapshots were fine. We could have automated it. To be honest, I took backups like this when I thought of it or when I logged into the interface, but we could have automated it easily. And they're relatively cheap, especially if we didn't have all that much storage. I'll say, too, we did our own backups sort of the old-fashioned way, using a free program called rsnapshot, which is based on rsync. Though we preach to students, use source control, and we just give them RCS, check in, check out. We kept it very simple. Rarely do they actually do it until they accidentally delete 10 hours worth of homework. So we actually were very aggressive. We took differential snapshots of our whole set of home directories every 5 minutes. So we spent a little more money on storage, but still only 200 gigabytes for the semester. Have 5-minute differential backups of our students' work, and honestly, that too saved us so many complaints, and saved them, frankly, so much stress. Unfortunately, the cost is we encourage bad habits, because look, David will take care of your backups for you. So we had a managed solution by Glenn and myself, but realize too, I mean, that was itself pedagogically useful, especially for 300 students. We see every possible mistake over the course of the semester. Oh, you lost your code? Well, it was intentionally an unadvertised feature because we want the students using source control, but we would have saved you had you come crying to us. as did happen.
But do you imagine that in the future, if it's more sophisticated, replacing source control in some way for environments where you have many people working?
I think so. I mean,
was the cost prohibitive if you actually, told everybody that you were doing this? Would it have been worse?
No, I think my only concern was not the money, because it was not expensive to do this. Again, we're talking an additional 100 gigabytes, which does not add up very quickly. It's really when you start talking terabytes that things really add up. I was worried about sending the wrong message that don't worry about making backups, don't worry about source control, because we will take care of it for you. But I think in the end, it was at least a 51% net positive for us, even though we risk sending teaching a bad lesson. This is the Elastic IP. So here's just the summary, if you like numbers and statistics. This is the way I've summarized for Amazon and outsiders how much we spent. So Amazon donated to us $5,000, which was plenty of EC2 credits for the course of the semester. In general, those considering this for other courses on campus, their rule of thumb thus far has been $100 per student. When I then told them we had 330 students, they said, how about $5,000 instead of $30,000? It was fine. It was plenty. And we were very sloppy with the money because we didn't really know what we needed. We were frantically trying to manage a course with hundreds of students, so we left more VMs running than we needed to at the time. But I think the message we sent and the capability we did have, even though we did not automate this as well as we could have, is we had the ability and we used the ability to scale our infrastructure up as problem sets got more computationally interesting. We absolutely did that. We just lazily did not often scale it back down. So among the PSETs, again, were cracking passwords and writing very high-performing dictionaries implementations, for which we did need more CPU cycles, not because 300 students or 300 users puts a huge load on your servers, but they do Thursday nights before the problem set is due. And that's when we saw spikes. And we were very easily, very quickly able to grow our infrastructure, if you recall our picture, just by adding the number of backends and load balancing across them. So you can see the upward trending of how many CPU hours we actually used. And all of these numbers come from Amazon's own accounting. You get a detailed invoice at the end of the month as to what you used. They charge you, though, essentially, and I got rid of some of the uninteresting pennies, but CPU hours, disk space. So you can see where we even bumped this up. I think we rolled out snapshots around now. I screwed up in the middle of the night and allocated an extra block volume. And at 4 a.m., I did not want to risk deleting the wrong one. So I just left it, to be honest. I mean, that's what pushed up some of our costs if donated. I/O requests, we did not know what to expect. So Amazon measures the read writes, essentially, to disk. They use I/O stats or the equivalent. And we had no idea what that was going to cost us. And fortunately, it was not all that much. If you look at the bill, that was far outweighed by this guy, followed by this guy. Bandwidth was not all that much either. What was interesting for us to see this increase, because in the middle of the semester, we had a bunch of problem sets that the students used disk for. We had them writing code that recovered JPEG files, for instance, from a corrupted compact flash image. So it wasn't a huge image, you know, a bunch of megabytes, but students were spitting out a lot of JPEGs, recovering a lot of JPEGs incorrectly and littering their accounts with a lot of files, but downloading them via SFTP to look at the JPEGs. So that's why we had a lot of storage space up there. And then we started tidying things up by not snapshotting things like JPEGs. So we fixed some things there. But it put things into perspective. And if you divide $5,000, which we roughly spent, divided by 330 students over the course of time, what we got was roughly, and the number we quote to people is, it cost us less than $15 per student. I'm quite comfortable saying we could have done it for less than $10 per student and maybe in the $5 to $7.50 range. But again, we were experimenting, and Amazon was very gracious in letting us do that without having to keep track of things carefully. They have a little calculator online. It's kind of a horrid interface, but you can fill in a lot of blanks if you want to estimate what your particular use case would cost you. But here's some problems before we actually let you run into some problems of your own. So by far, the biggest cost from my perspective was time. I mean, this cost me hundreds of hours, is probably fair, over the course of the past year. It was great fun, and I don't regret it at all. But because, one, I was new to the APIs and the tools. Two, I hadn't done a lot of system administration. Three, because... Well, those are the two big ones. It just took a lot of time. But I did not put a dollar sign on that. So there's no, what did I mean by, damn, don't leave a blank in your slide if you're not sure what it means. I honestly don't remember what I was supposed to say at this point. So there was not, there was something missing. Okay, but PEBCAC, so problem, okay.
For any.
Yeah, maybe that is what I meant, to be honest.
So there's no Emacs, there's no VI, for, you know, filling your
blank. Yeah, it's definitely, it was, the comment I had was definitely along those lines, and I mean, that's definitely a valid concern, but fortunately, we're using standard Linux distro, so installing stuff, very easy, burning our AMI, relatively easy, and you only do it a couple of times. But I will point to some others that I remember far more vividly. So I screwed up several times, my own fault, not so much the fault of Amazon. So this was actually something we didn't really chase down, and I don't think it's condemnation of EC2, because in fairness, we didn't do our own homework. But we did get several reports during the semester of lagginess. And frankly, these two quotes was from a student whose tone of his emails I will never forget, because he would send emails just with a subject line, cloud is laggy. And it was laggy the first time he sent it, and the second time, third, the fourth, the fifth time. Like, it was his own code that had an infinite loop or something like that. So he started to assume any little problem, like weak wireless signal on campus, cloud is laggy. But in fairness, we did have lagginess. I think a lot of that was the result, again, of the previous one. My own fault with misconfiguring LDAP, because LDAP is queried when you're checking file ownership of files. And so what we found was some misconfiguration or some bug in SLAPD whereby way too many open file descriptors were being kept, exceeding whatever threshold was built into the system. And we fixed it consistently just by cranking up in some config file, but we never had time to figure that out. So I do think it was a Linux problem, a sysadmin problem, and not something related to the cloud. But with regard to X-based applications, we did get more credible reports of just X applications because the servers themselves are in supposedly the Midwest and not on a bit connection on campus. The latency was much higher for applications like that. It's not a huge deal breaker for us because I tend not to promote X apps in this course, but definitely some of the staff have a preference and a penchant for that. So it's something to consider, and we're going to look more closely at it this semester to see if it was, again, a misconfig or if that's just the nature of the number of hops between us and the servers. This is a good one. We cannot put video content on these servers. We would blow through thousands of dollars way too fast. And this is a problem not unique to Amazon. I mean, we used to host stuff out of a DreamHost account. And even though they give you 2 terabytes of space, I mean, we blew through that within half of a month. So bandwidth itself is increasingly challenging just because content's getting bigger. And then there's this. So this is not tongue-in-cheek. So this was an article that happened like 2 days before I gave a talk like this at the USENIX conference a few weeks ago. Lightning struck a Amazon data center, and it blew something up in terms of power. One or more cabinets or cages went offline, which absolutely affected some customers. If you read kind of the fine print or Amazon's official statement, it was not an EC2 outage because it only affected one cage or one cabinet, something silly like that. So I did link to on the wiki page, which we'll leave up for a while after today, links to their service level agreement and some of these lower level promises so that you appreciate exactly what guarantees they do and don't make. This we already made mention of. I would say after today, especially if you're about to depart, the 3 most useful guides we found were these 3, available at those URLs in order if you want to play along at home. Amazon, to their credit, has done a wonderful job at documentation. There's so many cool tools out there whose documentation is awful. Amazon has really put together some nice guides, many of which I'll point you to today and are linked on the wiki. But it was relatively a pleasure getting oneself up to speed. They've made it relatively easy. And then lastly, since this is the focused audience here, so Amazon has, we were sort of a beta tester for them of sorts. We just kind of emailed them out of the blue and said, can you support us? And they were very generous and did. Now they've made it official. So there is a form at that URL where if you're in academia, you can say you're a researcher, educator, IT, whatever, and then make a proposal to them for grant support. And grant support means they give you EC2 credits, i.e. dollars, that get debited before your actual credit card does. And so that's what we'll hand out today is EC2 credits. And they gave us $5,000 in EC2 credits. And I will say, the folks over there have really been wonderful. So if you're looking to develop a relationship or actually do something that might benefit Amazon marketing-wise just by partnering with Harvard in some sense, I sense our guy in particular, who we've befriended, is really open and receptive to that. I mean, this too. When I asked him $100 credits, he said, sure, here are the codes. So they've been great. So any questions, big picture, concerns? Yeah, Bill?
What's the maximum number of
We used no more than 8 at one time. We started with 3 and went up to 8, I think. Yeah. Other questions?
Is there any kind of thresholding on the cost side? So not necessarily, you mentioned something similar. It sounded like there's no way, for example, to say, I want to fix this amount of credits. I don't want to use anymore. As soon as I run out, stop everything.
So good question. I don't believe so right now. Imagine stuff like that will come, but I don't believe those kinds of triggers or thresholds exist right now. Other questions? Yep. Oh, yes, so we'll touch upon it briefly, but S3 in short is their storage engine that is fundamentally independent from EC2. To use it if they just need a large storage space that is off-site. What's nice about it is that there exist tools that give you a folder on your hard drive to which you can upload files. But also nice is that they have an API. I think it's an HTTP-based API that lets you put files, get files, and just generally use it as an abstracted away file storage engine. And the costs are not terribly high. So it was, again, CPU hours that cost us the most. But so we'll talk about it only indirectly today because EC2 uses it, but to EC2 itself, it's a black box. It's a storage layer. Like confidentiality. So there are. So we've had conversations with various like security folks within FAS and the provost office who sent us emails when they read about our project in the Crimson. We don't store information that Harvard deems confidential on Amazon servers. So that seems to have put an end to that concern because we use it for fairly narrowly defined purposes. I'm sure folks like Scott Bradner and other companies would have, if a department really gets behind something like this, I'm sure that will induce many meetings and many conversations that we fortunately have been able to avoid largely because we just don't risk that. So I don't know where Harvard's at on that. I mean, encryption is possible. There exist layers that people have built on top of S3 that encrypts one's data. And I think my buddy in New York does exactly that. He has offsite backups using S3 because it's encrypted there. But even that, I imagine Harvard might want to be very careful about. Oh, and for reference, actually, Alex and anyone, on the wiki page under resources, there's a link to a white paper from Amazon on its security model, which is probably the place to start for a technical person as to where is stuff stored, what are the guarantees, what are not. Other questions? One more? Yeah? No? I suspect that's part of it. My understanding, and I only have a cursory understanding, is that their CTO, whose name I forget, has really been an evangelist behind this and was given the green light ultimately by Jeff Bezos to really run with this idea. But that's all I know personally.
So I've been CTO for about 20 years.
Oh, really?
And Amazon had this infrastructure. They weren't using it. It was built through huge peaks and valleys, so they don't have to use it. So it was just sitting there. Werner pointed out, Werner Bowles, you know, that there were people who pay money. What Amazon really brings is that you build that level of money off.
Yeah.
And this gives them the extra capacity that they need. By the way, your lagginess is going to go way up on Christmas.
Oh, interesting. Well, fortunately, someone changed Harvard's academic calendar, which means we're out of here before then. So,
so this gives them a pool of excess capacity that they can then make money on.
Interesting. Yeah. No, it's really been. I've been a huge fan because there really, to my knowledge, is nothing else quite like this. That now, certainly not on this scale. Well, shall we do this? One, let's officially adjourn this initial portion, so please feel free to depart. I'll answer questions up here if you'd like. Why don't we take a 5-minute donut break or bathroom break? Bathrooms are around the corner. There's actually vending machines downstairs around the corner. But if you're the type who just wants to dive in, let me suggest you go to cs50.net/wiki. Make sure you have the software available. And if you really want to start typing away, you can go ahead to aws.amazon.com over the next 5 minutes and just follow the link to sign up now if you haven't already, if you want to spend the 5 minutes that way. But thank you very much, and I'll stick around up here if you have one-on-one questions. We'll take a 5-minute break.